Guys, it's time for another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And today's guest is the great Rob Roberge. Rob is a novelist, and some of his books include The Cost of Living, More Than They Could Chew. He's got a story collection called Working Backwards from the Worst Moment of My Life, and he's also the author of the fantastic memoir called Liar, which came out a couple of years ago and was very recently reissued in paperback. If you haven't read Liar, you should go get a copy today because it's really a great read and one of the best memoirs I've read in a long time. So we had a really good talk. I'd never actually met Rob before face-to-face, even though we were virtually face-to-face via Skype. But we texted and emailed and communicated various ways over the years. We have some good friends in common. And I don't know, it felt like we really hit it off. We had a good time. And we spoke about his new novel that he's working on. It's about atomic testing in the Bikini Atoll. And we also spoke a little bit about Liar. And then we got off onto all sorts of tangents, talking about the corrupt respective East Coast towns that we grew up in, the virtues of coal oven baked pizza versus Chicago pizza. I'm not even going to say anything about Chicago pizza. We also, it happened to be, we recorded this on May 7th, and both of us, for some reason, were very much aware that it was the anniversary of the famous Willis Reed basketball game, New York Knicks versus the Los Angeles Lakers. I think it was 1970. And we talked about basketball for a while. A lot of times it seems writers want to talk about baseball. Rob and I got into basketball for a while, and that was fun. Anyway, we had a really good time talking, and I hope you enjoy this as much as I enjoyed speaking it, doing it, having it. What? How fucking corny does that sound? Anyway, yes, I've still got a cold. The weather here has been funky. We had about 3 days of summer, and then we went right back to winter again, and now I don't know what the heck it is. It's cold, it's drizzly, it's nasty here in Northern California, which is very strange for this late date in May. But what are you going to do? I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to listen to this conversation I had with Rob Roberge. All right, enjoy.
And this doesn't go on air, right?
Thank goodness for that.
I would have gussied myself up a little more,
yeah,
Bernard.
Yeah, to put on some pants, you know.
Hey, it's great to be kind of in person.
Yeah, I know. It's just actually, that's one of the reasons why this is fun. I get to, you know, we've chatted and texted and emailed over the years, but it's the first time I've ever seen you in sort of real virtual life or whatever.
Yeah, close, right?
Closest we're gonna get right today, anyway.
To hydrate. It's like I was at a rave all night or something. I'm like dying of thirst.
Yeah. Where are you living these days? Are you in Chicago?
In Chicago, yeah.
Okay, and what brought you out there?
Love. The only reason. Only reason to move to a cold shithole when you live in Southern California.
I hear Chicago's really great, other than the horrendous winters.
Yeah, they only last like 15 months. Yeah. So
I guess so. So this is still last year's winter that's almost ending before
it's like Ethiopia.
The new one began 4 months ago or something. Yeah.
You know, it is like 2011 in Ethiopia.
I did not know that.
They just do not play by the rules. They have their own calendar going. But it's not like the Jewish calendar, which is like observed, but not observed for workday purposes and, you know, plane tickets and things.
Yeah.
But they actually type tickets that it's 2011 and then you fly home and it's 2019.
Cool. What do I know about the Ethiopia is interesting because I think it was only in World War II the Italians took over Ethiopia, but I think it was like the only country in Africa that had never been colonized. They'd had their own sort of continuous king since.
That's so sad. Africa's enormous.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, terrible. they lasted like the 2,000 years or whatever since like the, you know, the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon's mines and all that cool stuff. But I don't know.
I got a bunch of research I've had to do for the new novel on the Bikini Island atomic tests.
Uh-huh.
And until Japanese missionaries appeared there in like 1890s, like the people of Bikini had never been like seen by anyone else or seen anyone else. Hmm. They just lived in this beautiful atoll, and then we kicked them all out.
Yeah, I was going to say, how'd that work out for them?
Bombed the fuck out of them and never gave them a proper home or compensation. And now, like, the entire Marshall Islands are going to go, they're basically at sea level, the Marshall Islands. Right. So climate change is going to make them non-existent in like 20 years.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun for all of us, I have a feeling.
But, not bad enough to bomb them to the Stone Age for no reason.
So what's the new novel about?
I mean, it's got a lot of plot stuff, but it's sort of a dual story of the effect of two murders on a family. One sort of institutional murder, a guy who gets radiation poisoning at the nuclear tests.
Uh-huh.
And then there's another patricide by another member of the family. So it's like two different generations growing up with various types of both personal and sort of institutional murder.
Uh-huh. And when does it take place?
1946 to 1994, like 50 years basically, which is, and it's multiple third. It's all this shit I've never done. So, of course, I'm worried it's going to suck.
Well, we always worry that, which is good. If you're not worrying that, then you're in trouble. You know, if you don't have some doubts, right?
The only writer I know, and he's hilarious about it. I used to be in a playwriting group with him. You know, every writer, the best, the ones you think are just unapproachable, will say, yeah, you know, I don't know. It's just not going well. I'm stuck. I don't know if I'm going to be able to finish it.
Right.
And this guy, you know, how's the work going? Great. It's the best thing I've ever done. Every time.
But does
I want to live in your world.
Does he actually write anything, or does he just like hang around in bars and cafes and talk about what he's doing?
Well, that would be easier.
Yeah.
But no, he actually writes and thinks quite highly of it every time.
What do other people think, though? That's the question.
He's good, but, you know, he's not too good for self-doubt that everyone on the planet has.
Everyone on the planet, but, I mean, artists and writers, especially, one would hope, right? I mean...
It's I think it's good for you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you don't necessarily have to have the imposter syndrome, but I don't know. It's like...
I have that, though.
Yeah.
I think I'm getting over it, but for years... It was funny because I was talking with a playwright whose work had been, we were in an evening of one acts in LA, and John Stepling, do you know his work?
No, I don't know.
Great, great playwright. He was on the weekly as the West Coast answer to Sam Shepard. His career was taking off, totally self-destructive person.
Mm-hmm.
Addictions, oppositional defiancy disorder. So like any authority figure, even if they were trying to help him, was the enemy.
It's so unusual, isn't it?
Yeah. Junkie, destroyed his career, you know.
I remember I told a friend of mine, a novelist, I said, yeah, I heard the other day that 75% of writers are alcoholics. And he said, that's all? Yeah. So.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they're, I used to do industrial painting, like painting bridges and airline hangars, and boy, 75% of them were drunks.
Yeah.
But I guess painting has a rep for that too.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, go ahead. You were saying he's got oppositional defiance disorder and.
Oh, all this stuff. But we were out, I was still smoking and he was smoking a cigar. we were out before the show just kind of pacing. And it was my first one act in an evening with a bunch of name poets, mm-hmm. like not some small thing. And you know, he'd been produced all over the world. And he says to me, he's like, "You nervous?" And I'm like, "Fuck yeah." And he's like, "Yeah, me too." And I'm like, "You? Why?" He's like, "Everything I ever put on, one act, full length, anything, I always expect there's going to be a guy in the back row who just stands up like sometime during the play and just screams, 'You're doing the same shit you do all the time. You got like three tricks, Stepling. You're a fraud.'" Mm. So you do the same three things over and over and over. It's like, I never forgot that. I was like, "Oh my God."
Yeah. Well, it's probably true too, right? You know, I mean,
there is a measure. Like Fitzgerald said, there's like, you know, we write about the same three things with different plots right. our whole lives.
Right, right. Writers write the same book over and over again in different ways, right? It's also, if I heard it. Yeah. So what is it that drew you to this idea of the split time difference in Bikini Atoll? Did you have, like, relatives or something involved in it? Or is it just something that piques your interest?
I think I mean, part of it's just, I think, a natural sort of, you know, again, among artists and addicts, perhaps this is widespread, but just an inherent distrust and dislike of governmental authority, and a sort of natural desire to pull for the little person. Mm-hmm. And this, and I just, you know, read an article about that, you know, World War II ended and we decided that we were just taking these poor 167 people who lived there forever and putting them on some godforsaken island that had trade winds and they couldn't even fish, you know, and it just seemed like, well, there's something there, but that was just the nonfiction part. And then got the characters. And the other part is based on a murder that took part in the town next to mine when I was in high school.
Mm. Mm. Is that the same? That's not the same one you discussed in Liar, is it? Or
No.
Oh, just another murder.
Just a murder happy little town. Yeah. it actually is. There's a shocking amount of murders. Like I came from Bridgeport, Connecticut, which is a city.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I know Bridgeport. I grew up on the East Coast.
Whereabouts?
Right outside of Providence.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're no stranger to local government corruption.
Providence, I don't know if you've ever heard this, has kind of a reputation for corruption.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bridgeport, too. Bridgeport's like the AA affiliate of the New York mob.
Okay. Well, Providence was like another major league player in the mob, right? There was the five,
yeah.
right? The five New York families, and then there was the Patriarca family, and
they owned the government.
Yeah,
I mean, they had them in their pocket. There, it was a really corrupt place.
Oh, there was. Did you ever listen to that podcast called Crime Town? And they did a whole series.
Is it good?
Oh, it was great. It was they did a whole series about Buddy Cianci, who is the mayor of Providence, on and off over the years between jail sentences, you know. But
Frank Rizzo.
But I mean, he actually started out as a crusader against the mob, and mm-hmm. then within like a dozen years of being like a young crusader, he decided to run for mayor, and then he was totally owned by the mob. He'd somehow transformed during that time. So yeah. And then he kidnapped his wife's boyfriend and tortured him and got caught for that and sent to jail for a few years. And then he was released and he ran for mayor again and won. And he was mayor again for a while until he was arrested again by the FBI.
he's like the Uber Marion Barry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He puts Marion Barry to shame.
Marion Barry only got to go twice.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have all this talk about whether convicted felons should be able to vote, but I guess in Rhode Island,
just not for themselves.
For yeah. Yeah, but in Rhode Island, you can run for office. But
yeah, that's an interesting.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I went off. I'll
oh no. You.
But so tell me about the corruption of Bridgeport, the AA affiliate.
Well, it's just. I mean, it's some I think the high end was family attached, like five families and stuff, but it was just like a satellite or operation, you know. But it's a port city, so, you know, in my neighborhood things fell off the truck all the time. That's where you get your steak and your radio and I fell off the truck down from the dock yard. It's like, when I was little, I was like, man, great shit falls off these trucks, Pop. It's like, do not get involved with it.
I remember when I was in high school, there was a local record store that just popped up, and it was like, wow, they got all these great records and they cost like 30% less than any of the other stores. And they're still brand new and sealed. It's a pretty good deal. And so how long did you were born and raised in Bridgeport? How long did you stay there?
Only until I was eight. Bridgeport was the first American city to declare for bankruptcy, before Lindsay declared it in New York. Yeah, we were on the cutting edge of destitute poverty. But the year there was a garbage strike when I was eight, it was just piling up and rats were, we just rented a sort of a two flat. We were on the bottom and the rats were just, the garbage was piling up in the street, literally. Mm-hmm. Smell was amazing. It was just brutal. And it was summer breaks. So it was like 90 degrees out. And, and like the big fun was to just like get your friends and go like poke at maggots, and then the rats went crazy. My mother's like, I don't care if we have to go into total debt. I need to get out of this fucking place. And they moved to a town like 15 miles north, like equidistant between Bridgeport and Danbury. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be a very, very strange little town, because the there's actually a section about it in the novel. There have been a remarkable amount of unsolved murders in that 10-mile area.
It sounds like what's the Stephen King town, Castle Rock or whatever?
Yeah, right.
Where it's like, why has nobody noticed all this weird shit goes on in Castle Rock all these years? But what's the name of the town?
Monroe.
Monroe, okay, because I know Danbury a little bit too, but
yeah, when I was little, I thought it was named after Earl Monroe.
Oh, cool. Earl the Pearl. Yeah, you brought that up. Today's the anniversary, May 7th.
It is the Willis Reed game.
It is the Willis Reed game. That's the part. That's the only thing I remember from that.
I think the biggest thing that Reed came out and he had a torn quadricep. And he hit the first two baskets of the game, and it was 4-0, and the crowd went crazy.
Right.
And he didn't score again, but he won MVP for the finals because he had been great before he got hurt. Mm-hmm. But no one remembers Walt Frazier against Jerry West put up 36 points, 19 rebounds, and 7 assists. I mean, Walt Frazier won that game.
Yeah, yeah. My favorite, one of my favorite basketball players of all time.
Me too.
Yeah. And because of his bodacious vocabulary, like when he
I had when I was a kid his autobiography that I'm sure was ghostwritten, Rockin' Steady, A Guide to Basketball and Cool.
Huh.
And I think what I needed was some really fly bell bottoms with wide lapel velvet and a Rolls Royce, because that seemed to be he was carrying that vibe for him.
Yeah, he also, I mean, he had the hat. He used to wear the mink coats and the whole the whole deal.
That's where he got the nickname. The Clyde nickname was from Clyde Barrow.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Dressed up, yeah.
Oh, okay, interesting. Yeah, no, I'd love, and it's great that the Knicks have done so well since those days, too.
Ewing curse.
Yeah.
And I hold it against them. I hope they never win again. They traded Charles Oakley. They traded Charles Ewing.
Yeah.
I don't care if they're declining in skills. Certain people you just let retire.
Right. They never should have traded. They never should have traded Ewing. That was horrible.
Seeing Ewing in a Seattle and an Orlando uniform, it just broke my heart.
And they turned the team over to Latrell Sprewell.
I like Sprewell.
Yeah.
But, But he's not a franchise cornerstone.
Yeah. But
I like anyone who chokes PJ Carlesimo every once in a while.
Yeah, you got to give him credit for credit for that.
I mean, that's not just getting in your coach's face. Yeah. That's like choking the man.
But it's so sad. It's like, you know, now I'm a Warriors fan because you know, I live here.
Well, I'm a Yankee fan, so I can't blame you.
Okay, all right. I'm a Yankees fan too. How about that? That's horrible. But yeah, I mean, I just couldn't even with the Knicks anymore. I think the final, there were a number of final straws. There was a number of times where I said, that's it. I'm done with this team.
You should use that, a number of final straws.
Yeah, there were a number of final straws that broke my camel's back in multiple places over the years, I guess. But there was the Isaiah Thomas thing and the Stephon Marbury thing.
I was just about to say Steve Francis, Stephon Marbury, Isaiah Thomas.
Yeah.
It was like it all went to hell in a year.
Yeah. And then for the next like 5 years, like through the playoffs, you'd see like former Knicks who they'd thrown away, like playing big roles on other playoff teams. And it was like, wait a minute, if they'd kept Zach Randolph and Trevor Ariza. Oh,
that's right. They had a young Zach Randolph.
Yeah.
Good player.
Yeah.
They had Eddie Curry when he was still worth something.
Well, he was never really worth.
Well, that's much. True. He never lost the weight.
Yeah, but then the final straw was the glimmer of hope that I had for the first time in like 10 years with the Lin Sanity, Jeremy Lin.
That was fun.
That was fun. And then as soon as Carmelo came back, he's like, "Get rid of that guy. It's all about me." And it's like, "Oh, Carmelo."
I'm not dominating the ball nearly enough.
Yeah. So anyway, they're talking about getting KD, Kevin Durant, right, and Kyrie, and I'm expecting nobody to go to the Knicks, and they're going to end up giving Boogie Cousins a max contract, and he's going to play a total of 14 minutes over the next 5 years. That would be my that would be the Knicks' way of you know.
I think your prediction has better odds of coming true than people who think they're going to get Durant and Irving.
Yeah.
I think, you know, they might get one of them, but your prediction has much better odds than them getting both of those guys.
Based on the previous results.
And if they get both of those guys, they're going to run into each other at the first practice and break every bone in their body.
Absolutely. If they get both of those guys, they'll never play together at the same time, and the Knicks will maybe get into, like, an eighth seed once or twice. Well, at least they're dependable, you know?
Well, at least we have the franchise charted, and we won't have to be surprised now. We don't have to pay attention.
Yeah.
We know that they're going to peak at like 42-40 and lose in the first round.
Yeah. But it's fine. I mean, I did for years. I said, I can't watch this anymore. And I'd still, you know, and I said, I can't. But I really, it's like, I'm, you know, I guess it was maybe ever since I saw James Dolan's blues band on YouTube that really, you know.
I heard about that.
Oh.
I just boycotted them when James Dolan threw Charles Oakley out of the
garden. Oh, yeah, that's right.
I cannot support you people.
Yeah, yeah.
You've had me since 1968, and now you don't.
But the guy's like so insane. It's like he opens up at like the Eagles or name your whatever giant yacht rock band is playing at like Madison Square Garden, and is like, no, the James Dolan 5 or whatever he calls his band. This James Dolan and the something, I forgot what it is. And he's, you know, we'll open for you. That's the deal. You want to play Madison Square Garden? We open. I mean,
that's a pretty nice little playground that boy has.
I guess so, but what a fucking egomaniac.
What an asinine thing to do. I mean, unless you're Buck Owens, you don't get to play your own club all the time. Like, you know, when Buck got old and didn't want to tour.
Mm-hmm.
He just built the theater in Bakersfield, his ranch was.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
So Buck and the Buckaroos would play every Friday and Saturday night, and they'd open for a national touring act.
Uh-huh.
And it's that's how you, you know, if you want to play your own stage, you got to be Buck Owens, not James Dolan.
Not James Dolan. Or else just, like, go play in, like, a little bar somewhere for a few. You know, you're just, like, you're a guy, and you're rich, and you can hire some, you know, great musicians to play with you, and you got go ahead, go play at a bar and have some fun. But
like he could play like, you know, places that are pay to play, like the Whiskey. They'd be thrilled to have a guy say, here, here's 20 grand. Let my band play.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean,
what is it to him?
There's this guy out here named, I don't know if you ever heard of this guy named Roger McNamee. Have you ever heard of him?
I don't think so.
He's a tech billionaire, and he was one of the original.
Thinking about doing that.
Yeah. Thinking about that. Yeah, I think you could take, I think there's like some continuing ed classes you can take to, you know, get on that pathway to how to become a tech billionaire. But,
so I'm sorry, what was that?
Yeah. So anyway, Roger McNamee, he's like in his, he's probably about 60 years old or whatever. He's been around for a while and he's been, had his finger in all these pies. He's one of the original investors in Facebook and he's worth fucking billions of dollars. But and now he makes a name for himself. You see him on news shows. He's a big critic of Facebook. You know, he's gone from being a, you know, a original investor and owner to one of their main critics about privacy and whatever. But at any rate, he has a band called Moon Alice. And you know, he's hired these the three guys who play in his band. I can't remember their names offhand, but they're like Bay Area legend kind of guys.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, guys who have played with all the, you know, with Santana or Jefferson Airplane or Quicksilver, whatever, all the biggest, you know, San Francisco bands, you know, from the 60s and 70s. And he's paying these guys a lot of money to play with them. And it's, you know, it's sort of what James Dolan should be doing. But it's this total vanity project. You see, you know, you're watching these guys playing and you're watching the bass player go, oh, my God, that guy's amazing. And it's like, oh, I could do what he's doing. Probably even a little better. And I suck.
It's like there was the head of the San Francisco Hare Krishnas in the, I believe it was the mid-70s. That chapter had gotten involved in gun running and drug dealing. Mm-hmm. And he was a codeine addict who thought he was the rock star Hare Krishna leader, because the original Pravda died in 1969, I think.
Uh-huh.
And he sort of had apostles, and like the 14 or 17 left all formed their own little,
okay,
like, you know, feudal nations.
And spinoffs.
And each trying to claim that they were the authentic head of the Hare Krishna movement. And this guy, Keith, the one in San Francisco, became a cocaine and codeine addict.
Uh-huh.
And they're running drugs and money to fund the Hare Krishnas. I mean, the West Virginia group killed people who wanted to leave the compound. There's an amazing book on it called Monkey on a Stick about high violent crime in the Hare Krishnas in the 70s.
I'm gonna write that down.
I love that book.
Monkey on a Stick.
Yeah.
You know, and, a friend of mine was actually telling me about something like that, about monks who were running cocaine through Sausalito here in the 90s.
What a world. But this guy thought he was a rock star.
Uh-huh.
And you know, they had all this drug and gun money. So he hires like a top San Francisco studio with studio musicians to do his Hare Krishna rock opera. And there's just a great scene in the book where the guitar player, like, it's just like, hey, I'm getting paid no matter what.
Yeah.
Like, because this guy's nodding out in the control room talking about how, like, he's, you know, he's Krishna, God of the world. And it's like, I've known a lot of drunk, stoned musicians in my time, and I'm fine just sitting here for time and a half.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care if he's Hare Krishna or not.
Yeah, if he's a seasoned studio musician, it probably wasn't the most egomaniacal thing he'd ever heard from somebody he was working for either, right?
It's a good point. You get exposed to the best and the brightest for those kind of gigs.
I mean, I could imagine what it was like to work with, say, Mick Jagger in the 70s when he was, you know, doing coke, you know. But, and so how are you still playing with your band?
Yeah. The guys have been great about it. You know, we just have an agreement that I can't come into LA for like one gig unless it's a big opening spot. Mm-hmm. Like if it's at the Wiltern or the El Rey or something, I'll come back for a single show. But otherwise we just do mini tours.
Uh-huh.
So I'll fly out to LA. We'll practice four or five days, and then just do like five dates on the road.
Oh, so you guys are playing out a lot. That's great.
Not much lately. Next, when I go out for my teaching residency, I'm staying a few days extra because we're working on the demos for an EP we're doing.
And the name of the band?
Oh, The Urinals.
Yes, The Urinals.
I did not name that band.
It's a pretty punk rock name, I have to say.
It's tough when you get saddled with something that was a joke when you were 18.
Yeah.
I'm the new guy. But those guys tried to change, and every time they changed, it would be like, whatever, like Spaghetti Doodle,
yeah,
formerly The Urinals.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. No, I know, because the name of, our magazine is Sensitive Skin, which started as a joke.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've always liked it. I guess I never, how certain names, like band names or magazine names, you just never question. It just rang off and it worked for you. Uh-huh. Whereas others, you're like, what the fuck is this about?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. All right. Well, that's good to hear. But yeah.
But I never made any literal connections with Sense. I just really liked, I like the way it sounds.
Oh, that's good. Cause...
And it's visceral. I like it.
Yeah. But I mean, it started because we were just about to launch this magazine in like 1991, and I'd just gotten back from France, and I had a bottle of shampoo that I'd bought in France because, I was too broke to throw stuff like that away when I was traveling. And you used to be able to carry big bottles of shampoo in your luggage back then too. And anyway, it said pour la peau sensible, for sensitive skin. And so, the magazine was originally called Peau Sensible, which was just ridiculous. People were like, so Piao Sensible. Nobody could pronounce it. And, then I said, finally, I got to change this to Sensitive Skin already.
You chose the right path.
Yeah, I think, I think so. But at the same time, sometimes it's like, I get an enormous amount of submissions of both pornography and for skincare products.
Really?
Yes, cosmetic products. Yeah.
Man, people like to do their homework, don't they?
Yeah, it's
like, I'll just send it out.
It's hilarious when like the when the letter begins like, I really love your magazine and I hope you take a look at this piece I wrote about exfoliation, like
I had a buddy who started a literary journal early 90s. Called 1812.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just labor of love helping him read for the first issue. And we get this letter from the cover letter from this guy who says how much he loves 1812. And they're like, he has old issues that he goes back to time and time again. Uh-huh. It's like, dude, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
you had to do a little more research if you're going to kiss someone's ass.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
It's not The New Yorker.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. It's just, I should go through my old emails and come up with a collection of these and just print them all out. It'd be kind of funny.
Of what?
Misplaced
proposals.
You should
do an anthology.
Yes.
Print on demand so it doesn't cost you much.
People would be very confused. Yeah, here's the Sensitive Skin anthology about cold cream and
the stuff we get.
Yeah, the stuff. It could be part one, the cosmetics, and part two, the pornography. Yeah, but because people also see that I've never not published anything because I found its content disagreeable. I've never,
right.
I know I don't care, but then sometimes, even serious submissions of people like, oh, he likes that really crazy, disagreeable stuff. And it's like, well, no, I just like good writing and I could care less if you're talking about, smuggling heroin and dildo stuck up your ass from Thailand or mowing your lawn in the suburbs. I really don't care, as long as the writing is good.
I hear you. That's my take,
Yeah. And I wonder where I why I remembered that. I did know a guy in France who did that, who smuggled. Yeah.
I think it used to be easier.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, everything used to be easier, didn't it?
Damn, I had a carved out boot. and my Telecaster, like, we would just routinely just shove everything up, like, you know, take apart the electronics, shove it up against the pick guard, tape it, put it back down, and
that was
yeah. I mean, TSA didn't seem to be taking apart pick guards at
right,
the time.
Right. Well, I guess there wasn't a TSA till all that. I mean, I remember, you know, now that's they right. go on to the whole thing with, like, do not, like, smoke on the airplane, and we'll kill you if we find you smoking in the airplane. I remember smoking weed on airplanes, you know.
Yeah. I remember remember when they used to fly to when the plane was a third full?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was flying to Europe for a semester abroad in 85. And we're flying over there. First of all, I'm underage and they're giving me free drinks. Mm-hmm. We're in the smoking section. So I'm chain smoking. And then the place is almost empty. And it was one of those giant aircraft that has five seats across the middle. Mm-hmm. So I'm lying across five seats, chain smoking and getting drunk and thinking, flying to Europe is the greatest thing on fucking
the glory days of flying. I know.
And I love that there was a smoke. I mean, because I was a smoker, like, when I waited tables, when I bartending, there was always smoking at the bar. But when I waited tables, or, you know, when I was on the plane, it'd be like, oh, you're in the no smoking section. You're in the smoking section. It's like one seat.
Yeah. I know. That was the most ridiculous thing. We're in this tiny enclosed area and you can smoke back there. It's like, what?
I'm just thinking, those people despise me.
Yeah.
But I'm just playing by the rules and I'm a smoker.
I know. It's funny. Yeah, it's funny. The smoking section on an airplane. It's not like there was like a plexiglass barrier that would keep the smoke in or anything.
Right. But yeah. Like in the way they did it at restaurants too, like people are eating, you know, people who don't smoke probably really disgusted right now.
Yeah.
But I always waited tables in the smoking section because they drink more. And they tip more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Smokers. God love a smoker.
Gotta love a smoker. What was I going to say? But I was recently in the Atlanta airport.
My least favorite, I think.
It's really horrible. I hate the Atlanta airport. And I'm always going, they've got that train and they, wait, yeah, which way am I going? I have to go this way or that way. I can't be. Yeah. But they actually have, I've not seen this, you know, smoking is basically like outlawed everywhere, right? It's just like, can't even smoke in your own house anymore in a lot of circumstances. For renters or whatever aren't even allowed to smoke in their own houses and stuff.
Sure, sure.
But in Atlanta, they're more, you know, whatever. They'll let you, you know, they'll let you do all sorts of crazy shit to kill yourself there. But they had a smoking room in the airport, and it was, and you walk by, and
was it just like filled? With
And it's just
that's like, how LAX used to have one of those. It was like this little, looked like a studio apartment.
Yeah.
You'd like walk out, and it was just like 20 people cramped smoke, and it was all plexiglass. It's like. Yeah. This is like an experiment to kill rats.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Do you realize what we're doing?
Yeah, the place is like a solid cloud, and you see the people in there like looking really incredibly miserable. Just, you know, smoking, like, yeah, the pure tobacco pleasure that they're they're getting in there.
Atlanta's weird because we played a festival there, I don't know, 6-7 years ago when I had quit smoking for 11 years and then stupidly picked it up. So I was smoking again at this point. And you could smoke on stage. Mm. And I hadn't been able to smoke on stage since I was in my 20s, you know, like back when, you know, Rockstar was the life plan.
Right.
with creative writing to fall back on, I had a great, great idea. But,
yeah, I always remember there was always certain guitar. Who was it? It was like, I guess it was like probably a lot of people did it, but I think Keith Richards was it. Always had like the cigarette sticking out of the headstock of his guitar.
Well, when I was in high school, I have a '69 Tele that I'm old enough that when I bought it, it was just a used guitar, not a vintage guitar.
And you managed to hang on to it all these years?
It's the only thing I kept through the dope years.
Wow. Good for you. Good for you.
Because we always draw every line. Like, I won't do, I won't do, I won't do. And then, right? And so I gave it to my ex-fiance. And I said, do not give this back to me unless I'm clean.
Oh, wow. A moment of clarity.
What's up? Blaze for dinner. What?
Blaze for dinner.
Sounds great. Thank you. Hey, sorry.
Rice? Rice for dinner?
Blaze. Blaze pizza.
Oh, Blaze. Okay. All right. That's Spartan, man.
What did you think?
I thought you said rice for dinner.
It happens sometimes.
Yeah. So it's
Gina's out of town, so it's either rice or we order pizza.
Okay.
That's not true. I do the cooking, but
and Blaze pizza, is it any good?
It's the only thing close to like a New York pie that I found in Chicago, and I'm a tri-state guy, like Jersey, New York, so Southwest Connecticut. That's my pizza.
Yeah.
Very picky.
You've been to Pepe's? Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. Never been to Pepe's.
I grew up with Caserta's in Providence, which is part of the holy grail of coal burning pizza places. I think there's Pepe's, and there's a place right next door. I forget the name of it. That's across the street. That's the same thing. That's also amazing. And then there's
Pepe's has four locations now.
Oh, they do. Okay.
And I was really disappointed.
Yeah.
Gina and I were driving from, I think, Boston to New York when she was on a book tour. And it was a really snowy Friday night. Her event wasn't until the next day, so we could get in as late as we wanted. And I said, you've never had a New York pie. We're going to Pepe's tonight. And it was snowing, and there was a line around the block.
Right, as there always is. There's always exactly. a block-long line there, yeah.
And she said, "You're joking." I'm like, "I'm not, and you will thank me." But then I went to one of the new locations, and it just something wasn't right.
Well, yeah, it's because there's those ones we just mentioned, and a few in New York City. There's John's and Arturo's and whatever. These places that have been there for 100 years, and they have the coal oven pizzas that are.
Right.
That have been illegal since World War II or something.
Oh, so that's why a new franchise can't keep up.
Yep.
That's why they can't do it.
Yep. They're trying to emulate it, but they can't, Yeah. But that's amazing that you held on to that. I had a friend who's, I won't say his name. He's a very accomplished guitar player, does a lot of studio work and whatever, but he got strung out in New York City in the 80s. And it took him from the first time he tried dope, the first time he ever tried it, to him selling his 55 Strat was 3 months. A 55 Tele, not a 55 Tele. And I can't remember. And he got the price that you would get for that at Thursday night at midnight.
Right.
So
I did a fair amount of that. I guess everyone, everyone did that stuff.
Yeah. Well, not everyone.
Well, seemingly most people I know.
Some people were taking their extra money and buying fucking Apple stock, I guess.
But... people were getting their MBAs.
Yeah. But whatever the exigencies of the moment that
But I don't get proud very often, but I have some pride that I kept the telly.
No, that's amazing. That's
well, yeah. That's... I mean, it lost everything else.
Yeah.
And it's starting with musical gear, you know, because that's worth something.
Yeah, I still have . I've lost most of the stuff I've acquired, but I still have some items that why do I still have this? like this, it's around here somewhere. I use it as a paperweight. It's just like this little miniature stone pyramid that I got when I went to Chichen Itza when I was 7, you know? Like, why do I still have, how did I hold on to this through like 30 moves and whatever? And, you know, and some of those moves were unscheduled. Let's say.
Nice word.
Yeah. wasn't exactly using a moving company or whatever, but
you have your hopper update set on the phone.
It was like, oh, man, I better take this with me. Better bring my pyramid.
There you go.
Yeah, that somehow made it into my backpack or whatever I was, using at the time. So I wanted to ask you about Liar. Is the paperback version's coming out now?
Yeah, it's out.
Oh, it's out. Okay. All right. And are you doing any book tours or readings for that? Or
I did a Chicago event. I may hit some – I did a Portland event, actually, because I was in conversation with Josh Moore. You probably know Josh, right?
I do. Again, lots of emails and conversations. Haven't actually – I don't think I've ever met him face-to-face. We've walked by each other in the same room a few times, but – I think he's a great guy, even though
he is. You guys would really get along.
Yeah, yeah, and he's a great writer. I love his work.
I do too. Yeah, like the last novel, I just loved.
Was that the one with the people jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge? That was amazing. Right. Yeah. What was that called again?
All This Life.
All This Life. That was great.
Yeah. I really liked that book a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was something about the way you wrote Liar that I really loved. The fact that you were skipping around in time from the very beginning and just like little tidbits and then, you know, from different parts in your life. And then all of a sudden it was like 1912, the last lemur in California goes extinct or whatever it was. Or something like that. Yeah. And I also remember when I got to the end, I was like, fuck. I was like, and again, we'd never actually met, but I was like, I called Patrick up, Patrick O'Neill, and I was like, is Rob okay? You know. And then I realized, oh, that was the section from 2009. Okay. He's but Patrick, yeah, Patrick laughed. Yeah, he's doing great. So.
Well, I get this tax bill from the city of Los Angeles where I've never lived.
Nice.
And they want me to pay a business tax. And I'm like, what? I lived in the county of Los Angeles, but this very specifically says I owe you $600 a year for writing in LA. It's like,
are you serious?
Never lived there.
Because you're an because you're an independent businessman as a novelist, and they want. Oh man.
Long Beach had you needed your license. If you were a freelancer, you were technically in business. But, I don't know what this LA thing's about because I never lived there, proper.
You never lived. Where did you live in Southern California?
Long Beach, Pedro.
Uh-huh. Okay. Did you ever live out in the desert?
In Desert Hot Springs for a little while, but I have a cabin up in the high desert in Wonder Valley outside of 29 Palms.
Oh, okay.
And I'm keeping that in the divorce, so.
So you're next door to Craig Clevenger or?
Oh, Craig stays at my place all the time.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Because he hasn't built his place.
He still hasn't built the place?
No, I think he should sell, like, the property probably really increased in value, and he should just sell his property. Because he bought just a plot of land.
Right.
There's so many, like, abandoned shacks out there that have the bare bones. It just seemed like you'd be better off buying one of those.
Yeah.
You know, rather than pulling permits from, you know, surveyors and things like that.
Now, I remember him telling me about that shit. It must be like 8 years ago or whatever that he got the film option and he had a little bit of money. And
right.
Yeah. But he was like showing me like online all these things from house. Oh, I'm going to do that. So. All right. Well, I guess he figures he's got a place to stay already. So why?
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have been so. He's never going to build that house.
Yeah, should you get to see what hospitality gets you?
Hey, that cabin's got good juju. I've had three bands have recorded there.
Oh, wow.
I had a friend who edited her film there. I've recorded a bunch there. I've written books there. Craig wrote Mother Howl, a lot of it there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it has a good sort of track record going for.
Oh, that's great.
You know, my you know, artists who need a couch, friends.
And it's funny because, you know, I remember him talking about that area and, you know, you're there and whatever. I finally got out there to, goddamn, I'm losing my mind, to the big park, the
Joshua Tree.
Joshua Tree, Jesus. Joshua Tree, which I've heard about for my
love
whole life
park.
And always seen, like, Keith Richards hanging out in, you know, Joshua Tree, and Graham Parson got buried
right
there and all that stuff. And I'm sorry to differ on your opinion. I thought it was the fucking creepiest place I'd ever been in my life.
Really?
Yeah. I got like, you know, sometimes you just like get that feeling. Like I was like walking around and it's like, oh God, this place is giving me the creeps. It's like, it feels like I'm walking around and here's like a bunch of kids, like kind of weird looking kids camping. And like they could like murder me and nobody would ever know. I was there by myself. No, but in 29 Palms, like all the beat up like trailers where the ex Manson family folks are living. Isn't that where Manson like had the families
no,
out there?
They were out closer to Death Valley,
okay,
a little farther north and I believe east.
Yeah. Okay.
For a while they were living in a closer desert. It wasn't quite the high desert around Joshua Tree. But yeah, I forget the name of the, oh, Spahn's Ranch was where they were staying.
Right. Well, no, that was when they were in LA, but then they had their desert compound.
Then they moved to Death Valley.
Okay. Oh, it was Death Valley? I thought it was 29 Palms for some reason. No. Okay.
No. No, and Charlie had this theory they'd all go underground and there'd be a race war and then the family would come up because African Americans weren't smart enough to run their own country and Charlie would take over.
Right.
It's good to have a plan.
All right, man.
So we're done?
I think we're done. I think that was fun. It was just really good talking to you.
It has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. It's a real pleasure.